Hey everybody, it's Alyssa Klein. You're tuning in to episode 2 of Filminist Pod. We're recording with our friends' listening party inside Canal Street Radio. Enjoy.
You don't own me. Just one of your many toys.
We have a very exciting guest today. With us here is Valerie Complex.
What's up? How you doing?
Good, good. Well, let's just get right into it. Would you mind introducing yourself?
Hello, my name is Valerie Complex. I am a military veteran turned freelance entertainment and film writer, film critic. I am queer. I live in New York City and I'm in my 30s, and people tell me I'm popular, but I don't know. I don't know what that means.
I do think you are popular. I also think you're one of the kindest people that I've interacted with on Twitter and now in real life.
Thank you. I'm blushing.
So for everyone tuning in, I haven't known Valerie that long, but in the time that I have known her, it seems like she's someone that is really just all about helping other people out. And even for me, you reached out and invited me to a meetup of different people in film journalism. And that was so kind. And honestly, no one's ever done something like that for me. I mean, people have done, don't get me wrong, people have done nice things to me, but in film journalism specifically, no one's ever done that. And that really meant so much to me.
Wow, I don't even know how to respond to that. I can't, it's really hard to be like, oh, you know, you're welcome or whatever, because I feel like it's just being a decent human being, you know, is what I was just trying to do. So I think everybody, especially like us of marginalized communities, should all sort of stick together, especially in film criticism and entertainment journalism, because it's a small pool of us. So,
well, on behalf of everyone out there, thank you.
Oh.
Thank you for being you and just spreading the love and helping other people.
Thank you.
I was wondering, could you kind of just share your own story of how you came to be involved in film?
Well, I've always kind of been involved in film. I was an actress for a while. I did a couple of movies where I had really small parts. I did some voiceover work in Japanese animation for a while. Not for a while, once. And then I did some voiceover work.
And one question. Mm-hmm. Was that in Japan?
No, that was here.
Okay.
I was like doing a English language dub for a movie that never came out. and then I joined the military. I was doing a ton of other things at the time too, but then I joined the military and that all sort of came to a stop up until the last year. So in 2013 is when I started writing. A website called Movie Pilot was looking for writers. You didn't have to have experience or whatever. So I was just, I published my first, I guess it would be movie review, which was for Riddick, which was the third movie in the Chronicles of Riddick saga. Movie sucked, by the way, but I did a review and man, they, you know, promoted it or whatever. And people, I mean, they started, it was like my first experience with like internet railroading, like, they were saying that this movie's not made for women and you don't understand action and everything. And I was like, okay, so I guess this is what this is going to be like. Good. And so I just started writing like more stuff. And then I would write for small like indie sites. And then I got the courage to start pitching. And yeah, now I am where I am now. I'm just through like hard work and asking people for help, which is kind of difficult, but I did it anyway. And suddenly, like, people reach out to me now to do things, which is still very surreal. After, you know, remember to sort of appreciate that, you know, appreciate the fact that I get these opportunities and always, because I feel like I sometimes get down on myself for not being bigger than I am, but that's just me comparing myself to other people instead of like acknowledging what I have going on.
And you served in the Air Force. Would you mind just sharing a bit more about your experience?
I joined the Air Force out of desperation, actually. I was 25 with a college degree and no job and no hope of getting one with a degree. So I was like, well, the Air Force is like the only option, because that was the only branch that was available the day I went into the recruiter's office, surprisingly. So I joined, and, you know, I went in like, I'll take whatever job you give me, which is a very bad idea when you go into the military. But I got lucky and I became a supply chain management professional. And I lived in Korea for a year, and I lived in Germany for 2 years, and I lived in Virginia for 4 years. So I was in for a total of 7 years. When I got deployed to Luxembourg, because that's the kind of branch the Air Force is, sometimes you'll go, you know, over to the Middle East, and sometimes you'll deploy to Luxembourg. I hurt my back, and then 2 years, and then in 2014, so that was like, that was 2010. 2014 is when I got medically separated from the Air Force, and I moved to California to try to pursue whatever this was with journalism. That didn't work out. So I was there for 2 years and then moved back to New York. So I was gone like 8 or 9 years from the city.
And would you say that your time in the Air Force has kind of informed your perspective on films and TV at all?
Yes. It made me more attuned to what I see in military films now. When I'm like, oh, that's wrong. That's not accurate or whatever. It just made me more of a snob. And it made me, it gave me a lot of time to sort of work on what it meant to be involved in film and how to look at film. Cause I spent a lot of time watching movies, cause you know, there was a point where I was working nights and, you know, I was working 6 days a week. So film was all I had. And so, I learned a lot about like below the line work and stuff like that. And I was doing some editing, some film editing work on the side to make extra money. Yes, make extra money in the military because people are broke. And so when I got out, I just had this newfound respect for film and television. But I didn't get into the activism aspect and didn't know quite as much about the racial dynamics until I started to write for bigger websites. And that's when I was like, oh, so there's like this disparity. And yeah, that came like way later though. You know, after several pitfalls and like failures. Yeah.
So you've been in the film journalism world for a few years now.
Mm-hmm.
Have you noticed the landscape change at all? Are there issues that are still the same? I guess, has your experience in the film journalism world, how has it evolved?
If we're talking about like more women working in film journalism, no. If we're talking about are more people of color being hired by major outlets, no. If we're talking about the industry is still being overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly male, still, then yes, still the same. I do think what has happened is there's been a surge in people creating their own sort of websites and trying to create their own platforms. But, you know, that's difficult. It's it's not easy to, it's not easy to sort of navigate that with your own website, because if you're broke, then you gotta pay, and you have to pay for web hosting and web design and stuff. You have to pay for it, and it gets expensive if you're not someone that, you know, can run a site. But you know, a lot of sites are free, and you can, you know, create your own sort of thing if you're fine with, you know, getting very little views and no money, you know, no ad, you know, advertisement or anything like that. So I think that part has changed. People have become more fearless in terms of the content they want to create. People are creating platforms for themselves. That's changed.
Yeah. My favorite thing to do when a big release comes out is to check Google News and see who's writing the majority of, or really all the reviews that are showing up on the first page on Google News. And I haven't seen a time where it's not overwhelmingly white men.
You're not going to ever, it's not that you're not going to ever see a time. Just right now, it's like mad difficult, because like, I don't know, because they are the ones with the jobs. They are the ones with the staff jobs, you know. They work at companies that have enough money to send them to Cannes and TIFF and South by Southwest and wherever else they go.
And I'm going to have some questions about that in a second.
Okay.
But, yeah, I mean, anytime, like, for Captain Marvel, I did some tweets for my personal Twitter, just show, like, saying the obvious, that the overwhelming majority of Captain Marvel reviews, specifically at the bigger mainstream platforms, were written by men. And people who just so happened that they are the mug of variety were the ones tweeting at me saying, like, there's nothing stopping women from writing reviews. But to your point, it's one thing to just go ahead and write something, but it's a whole other to get paid what you should be getting paid to do it in front of, so that people see it.
And the thing about, like, you know, that was why Brie Larson said all of that stuff in the first place, because when her film, The Unicorn Store, premiered at TIFF in 2017, I believe, it was, the film criticism was dominated by white men, and they didn't view the film favorably. And that's when I think she took notice. And I'm really glad that she did, because, you know, look, and you see when different, when women, or when, you know, different types of people watch The Unicorn Store, how their reactions were different and how it touched different people. And I think that's why we have to have a variety of different narratives and voices speaking about all types of film, not just, yes, I'm a black woman, so having just talk about black film, like, I can do that if you pay me, but I watch more than that. So, I don't know. It's just weird. We just need more. We need all kinds of people, people with disabilities, trans women, indigenous people, black, white, you know, we need, you know, both, all genders involved in telling, you know, and interpreting what they see.
So you recently attended Cannes. For people who didn't follow your Twitter feed, would you, I don't know if you've spoken about Cannes at length yet, but would you mind just, first of all, telling people what you were there for?
I went to I went to Cannes for a website called Awards Watch, and it was a last minute thing. He had an open slot. He had been accepted. He had gone before. Eric Anderson, who's the EIC, he had gone before. He had a relationship with the people at Cannes. And I was like, you know, if I can raise money, I'll go for your site. And so we came together and we devised a plan. And then I put out a GoFundMe. I never anticipated the GoFundMe to reach the goal in 24 hours. 24 hours, my goal was reached. And
well, I can't say I'm that surprised, given you're just so, I think people are looking for any opportunity to support you, given how supportive you are to other people.
I'm still shocked by it to this day. And like, you know, I raised like, the thing was to raise like $3,200, and I ended up raising like $37 on GoFundMe, and then I got like an extra $1,500. It's just weird. And I'm thankful to, you know, Black women really came through for me. For that, like, they donated the most, their donations were the highest, and I'm not shading anybody. I appreciate all the donations that I've received from everybody. Mm-hmm. I just noticed that Black women really were the ones who were like, came through and was like, I want to see you do this. I want to see you go here and represent.
Did you have a favorite film that you saw there?
Yes, of course. Portrait of a Lady on Fire by Celine Sciamma. See, the thing is, I only got a chance to see like 5 or 6 movies because the landscape of Cannes is very difficult to navigate if you're a first timer, if you don't know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, people didn't prepare me as much. And I think I rejected that because I wanted to figure it out for myself. I'm sorry, I know that.
We're in New York City, so there's sirens. This happened in our first episode.
It's a soundtrack of New York.
Yeah. So for anyone who hasn't been to Cannes, what would you say a first-time experience is like?
Okay, well, I'm going to tie this into the my favorite film. But mm-hmm. The thing is like, Cannes is, there's like 3 or 4 different film festivals going on at one time. Mm. There's Cannes Film Festival, there's Directors Fortnight, and there's Critics Week. And both of those are showing films, and they all have different schedules, and they're all in different places. And like, it's like a 3-mile radius of like, one film could be at one end of the strip, and another film could be at the other end of the strip. And it's like, okay, so you see one movie, you get out, and now you're at the Festival Palace, and now another movie's like 2 miles down the road. Now you got to get an Uber, or you got to walk. And like, Cannes has a lot of hills, and it's just, it was just difficult to navigate. I found myself in pain a lot. Like, you know, I'm not a spring chicken, so like, bad knees, the heels hurting and everything. And it was tough, like, physically. And because I would get lost or I would miss screenings because I was at the wrong place, it was difficult. So I only ended up seeing 6 movies. And my favorite of them being Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which is a queer film. It's not terribly diverse, but look, you got to take what you can get at Cannes because none of the films are terribly diverse. So whatever. And it's about 2 women who fall in love in 18th century France. Yeah, 18th century France. And then there was another movie I saw that I liked called Atlantique by Maddie Diop, who won the Grand Prix. At Cannes, so that's like
and there's these super iconic pictures of her. To me, they're iconic of her with her trophy. Mm-hmm. There, I thought that was cool.
Yeah, she, you know, they give you trophies or whatever. And the Grand Prix is like the second, it's like coming in second place. And you know, I never got a chance to see Quentin Tarantino's movie or see Parasite because I wasn't there long enough. But it's like the festival, the Palace Festival, has 5 or 6, it probably has like 8 theaters in it. But depending on which theater it is, depends on what part of the building you enter through, it's a headache. And then it was just a lot. I spent most of my time at parties networking with people and stuff because I would miss screenings, so I had to end up somewhere, so I'd end up there.
Is there anything that you wanted to touch on, and no pressure, just your experience as a Black woman being at Cannes? I saw your tweets. I watched some of your videos on Twitter.
It was interesting because I didn't meet any other African-American journalists. The only African-American journalist that was there was Jacqueline Coley, who's at Rotten Tomatoes, and we were roommates. So,
oh my gosh. Yeah. When and where?
We were roommates at Cannes.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, so it was like, okay. And, you know, I was going around and I was looking and I met a ton of, you know, Black African-American producers, directors, no journalist, just me and Jacqueline. And that was interesting.
And that's at one of the biggest film festivals in the world.
Yeah, and it's not a joke when I talk about how expensive this place is. The plane ticket was like $1,500, and the lodging was like $1,000. Like, it was so expensive that you could say that I almost went broke while I was there. Because it, like, they price gouge and nobody sees a problem with it. They charge like 27 euro for a salad and 20 euro for a hamburger with fries. And they really like, it's like, and the only other food there, if you're trying to eat healthy, is like greasy donors. And that's like 14 euro. It's like, I can't eat that shit every day. So, it was, it's very expensive. So I understand why. Because somebody asked, like, why don't black outlets like Essence and BET or whatever send people out? It's expensive.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough enough for outlets. I used to work at a publication. I was an editor. I know how tough it is with budgets. And it's tough enough to pay people what they should be getting paid for, right? Let alone to send them on this huge undertaking.
So I can understand why you just didn't see like a ton of African-American journalists, but also like, I get it. Like I have like very strong, prominent African features, and it's probably easy to tell that maybe it's somewhere in my ancestry that, you know, my family comes from a certain part of Africa and stuff like that. But what was interesting is, you know, I wasn't being othered like, you know, some of the other black people that were there, maybe those that were lighter skinned or whatever. I just had more European features or whatever. So people would approach me and think that I was like, you know, either from France or I was like from Africa, from a French speaking country. And treat me like shit. So at first I was trying to be nice, you know, respectful and speak in French, and then ask if they speak in English, you know. And then after I started doing that, I think I spoke French a little too well. And people started just antagonizing me and treating me like crap. So the first situation, was I was standing in front of the Ritz-Carlton on the Riviera. And I was, you know, dressed in all black, and I, you know, standing there waiting for an Uber to take me back up to where I was staying. I had just picked up some tickets to a premiere, and this lady asked me if I had tickets, if I was selling tickets or whatever. I'm like, selling tickets? I'm like, what do you mean? And it took, like, all the stuff that happened to me, it took me a while to, like, compute, because I was, like, so tired, so jet lagged. I was like, mean by that? I was like, no, I'm not selling any tickets, because I had the envelope in my pocket. I was like, I'm not selling anything. And I went home and to ask Jacqueline what the hell that was about, and she was like, oh, they think that the Africans scalp tickets. I was like, well, okay. And you know, I get it. Like, the only Africans I saw at Cannes that might have been locals were sex workers and like people selling like umbrellas and like different things on the street stuff. And so then I went to go see Atlantiques, and I was waiting outside. You know, people were coming out, the movie was over, and I was waiting outside because I actually wanted to stand outside and see what kind of people were coming out of the theater. You know, it was mostly white folks, so whatever.
To like, Atlantique.
Yeah. And this white lady had come out, old white lady, in her accent, and she was like, I did such a good job in the film or whatever. And she said something else. And I was like, what does she mean by that? And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe she probably thought I was in the movie or something like
oh
that.
Oh my gosh.
And you know, you just laugh it off, keep yourself from like crying or whatever. And it would just be different things like, you know, being ignored at parties or being the only black person there. Or, you know, I surrounded myself with a core group of other white folks. Because they were my friends, but also, I'm not going to lie, it was like a shield of sorts so that I could field off some of the drama that might happen to me, because I had to protect myself or whatever. There's another time I was going into the premiere of something, I don't remember what it was, and like the security harassed me over a pack of gum, telling me I couldn't take a pack of gum in.
Oh my gosh.
Me. And then I had to like yell back in English, and that's when they sort of backed off a little bit. And then after that, I just started being like overly American because I was like, I'm not going to be treated like shit. And I don't care what you say. So, you know, people would introduce themselves. Bonjour, merci. I'd be like, hi, how are you? How you doing? you know, and they, you know, then they started asking, are you here for Cannes and stuff like that? So that's just part of the experience. You know, the movies are, it really, the industry helped. I learned a lot from going to those parties. I learned a lot about producing and met a lot of female producers and stuff like that, and learned about sales and marketing and stuff that I thought was, that
That's
which I
awesome.
Thought was interesting.
And, I know nothing about that.
And I also learned that a lot of films at these film festivals, even if they feature people of color or somebody from a marginalized community, it doesn't mean that that film is for us, right? So I saw a film there called Port Authority, which is a queer film that I hated. But, you know, it wasn't a film for me, even though the marketing is deceptive. Like, oh, yeah, whatever. But that's how it is. They market it to a demographic in hopes that you buy in. And then when you see it, you're like, oh, this is not a movie for me, you know? And so a lot of film festivals have, especially Cannes, a lot of film festivals have those kinds of
phony representation and non-inclusion.
Yeah. Phony. I like that. Phony representation. It's fraudulent, but it's just the way it is. They like, you know, they're not concerned with change.
Mm-hmm.
They don't give a shit. You know, they have security guards parked outside of premieres, like actually scrutinizing women, looking at them up and down, making sure they have the right heels on.
Did you have to wear heels to the screenings you went to?
No.
Okay.
No. You know, press.
For premieres.
Some premieres you press could get into without having to dress up.
Okay.
And then some premieres they couldn't. It just depends.
I would be so upset. I haven't worn heels in like 3 years. I don't know what I would do because I'm not gonna, like, I'm in a baseball cap and a tank top and sneakers, like that's my normal outfit. I'm just not gonna wear heels.
Yeah, you have to be careful what you wear, and it's one of the most pretentious bureaucratic things I've ever attended. But also, like, they plan it around exclusivity. There are only, like, you know, if you go to TIFF, you might have, like, 5 showings of a film throughout the 2 weeks. But at Cannes, it's like you either see it on premiere day or you see it the next day, and that's it. And that's fucked up. I think it's so messed up.
Yeah.
Some films had, like, maybe 3 showings. Like, I almost didn't see Portrait of a Lady on Fire because I'm like, they're late.
Mm.
But they let me in, and I had to sit in the first row at 10:30 at night.
10:30?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, at 10:30 at night. And it was, man, it was something. It was really something.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. It was an experience, one that I won't forget. A lot of people ask me if I'm plan on going back, and I'm like, I don't know.
So one of my dreams as a journalist has been to attend Cannes someday, and just after hearing your experience, I have no interest in going. Like, I had a tweet pinned to my Twitter that was like my 5 career goals: 1, interview Ava, interview Kristen Stewart, go to Cannes. I took it down from seeing your tweets, because I'm embarrassed that was so central to my goals. And it's just made me realize that we really need to kind of like reassess what it means to what kind of things we value, specifically talking about in film and TV. And I guess in 2019, like, what relevance should a festival like Cannes have, which centers itself around exclusion?
What relevancy?
Oh, that was like a rhetorical question.
I'm thinking about it, and I'm like, stuff like that is so, they, It's archaic, but the thing is that it's upheld by these major outlets. So it's like a thing. And everybody who sort of values these major outlets sort of values this film festival that is so behind, you know, but people keep going. And they keep allowing people like Roman Polanski to have films there, and Gaspar Noé, who hates women, clearly, they keep having his films there. And that's just the kind of atmosphere that they embrace. And it sucked. So I met a lot of great people while I was there, but I don't know. I like TIFF. TIFF is a better one, a better film festival. So South by Southwest, great, had great access and everything. The only reason why I was able to go to all of these parties and all of these things is because people I knew would hook me up. Other than that, publicists didn't reach out or anything like that. They didn't give a shit.
So maybe going forward, like I feel like one thing I can be doing, if ever I have the opportunity to write about Cannes, not just, not attend, but write about it for an outlet, maybe add an asterisk, like, it's Cannes, but it also is grounded in patriarchy and white supremacy and all these things that we're fighting against. Anytime we write about it, maybe we should add those things as well.
That's why it's important to have different, like, people, different types of people going, because... You know, all the initiatives with the film festivals in the U.S., excluding Telluride, that is different. But, like, you know, TIFF sending scholarships to marginalized critics and Sundance.
That's
and
awesome. I didn't know they do that.
Southwest, they do that. They do that because of myself and a couple of other film critics of color who made sure, who devised a proposal and submitted it to Time's Up. And Time's Up were the ones to sort of enforce that. And that's why, like, that didn't come out of nowhere. That didn't come out of the goodness of the film festival's hearts. That came from the work of mostly women of color who are the most displaced in this industry, trying to get a fair shake. And, you know, when it's one, you get over one hurdle and it's another. And now you got to deal with publicists and those shenanigans, which is like a whole nother thing. If, you know, so there's still always going to be barriers to doing your job if you're a woman of color who is unstaffed, which is half the population of writers. So, yeah.
Now, okay. So to pivot from Cannes, you got back from Cannes a few weeks ago, and I believe it was last week you put out a crowdfunding page for a comic that you're involved in.
Oh, yeah.
Braxton. Uh-huh. Braxton Regenesis.
Yeah, Braxton Regenesis.
Could you tell folks what that is and what your involvement is?
Well, last year, the company was called Arclight Comics, but now they're Make. We are Make Comics, and... We, last year, I approached Ed Williams, who's the founder of Make, and he had put out a call online. It was like, we're looking for writers, this, that, and the other. And I reached out and was like, is this paid? And he was like, well, no, it's like an internship. And I was like, you can't do this. You can't, like, ask people to do something and not pay them. You know, him and I talked, and then we worked out something. And he was like, well, why don't you get on board with Stephanie Williams and write this character? And I was like, well, I've never done a comic book before, but I will give it a shot. So we've been working on it for a year, and we're finishing up the edits and the script. And the Kickstarter is out, and we're looking to raise $25,000 so that we can get out the... you know, a decent amount of perks and things like that to people, and pay folks.
That's, you know, awesome. Their time. And what is Braxton about?
Braxton is about a woman. It's Regenesis is an origin story about how this black woman from New Orleans who lost her mother to cancer was given up by her father, was given to an assassin's guild, and was raised and trained by them, and discovered that she, at the Assassin's Guild, she discovered she is queer, but she also discovered that she is a sort of metahuman. She can regenerate cells, and she uses a power that sort of is like spatial awareness, and gathering, you know, just sort of quickness on her feet, almost like it was an animal that was used to describe it, but like a cat almost.
Okay.
How she sort of leaves the Assassin's Guild and is on the run from them and is raising her child and trying to lead a low profile.
Cool.
And she's a part, really quickly, a part of a larger universe, which is in a larger group called The Hope, and it's ordinary people who become superheroes and save the world from. And in this group is like a disabled superhero, a fat superhero, a Maori superhero, Asian woman, a black woman who's queer. And so, you know, this sort of universe that's coming together is truly inclusive. All kinds of people exist within this universe, and there's something for everybody.
So it's Pride right now. Do you have any films or TV shows that you would put on your Pride watch list?
I just wrote an article for Stylecaster about this, but if you can see Rafiki, see that. Portrait of a Lady on Fire is coming out in December, but it's probably going to be on the festival circuit. So if you can see it at New York Film Festival at TIFF, you need to see that. That's like,
I'm so excited.
I'm not big on endorsing like all white cast movies, but that's the one that I've taken on for the year. I'm not interested in taking on any others, but at least that one's gay, and you know, I can take that one on.
We all need quotas for white film quotas. And I'm in.
That's it for me. What else that I enjoy? So there's Rafiki, there's Portrait of a Lady on Fire, there is Eliza y Marcella, which is on Netflix right now.
I still need to see it.
And, you know, it talks about the first same-sex marriage between two women in Spain in 1901. I'm behind on my gay content. I haven't seen Carol. I need to see it. I know I'm a terrible lesbian, but I still need to see that.
It gets like widely panned when the queer community talks about Carol, it's like in a not great light.
And that's probably because the two actresses in it are straight women.
Yeah.
Not like Portrait of a Lady on Fire, where at least I know for a fact one of the actresses is a lesbian. Adele Haenel, I think that's her name.
So I saw.
Oh yeah, watch Pose.
I'm awful and still have not started. And I have friends who are friends with Janet Mock, and so every once in a while I get to be at parties and events that she's at, and more so than anyone else, I like freak out in her presence, and I get so shy, and I like have to go to another corner of the room because I don't know what to say to her.
We went to an event at Twitter, and some of the cast members from Pose were there, and we watched the opening, the season opener. And it's such a great show, and it's so New York, and it's so queer, and it's really the lifestyle that I remember because I grew up hanging out at the pier and been to a couple of balls. You know, this is before I was even out as a lesbian. So it's very true to life, and I like that.
And it was just picked up for a new season.
Yep, and it should be. And it should be even like, it's a wonderful show. We had a good time.
Janet Mock just got that like groundbreaking deal with Netflix.
Yeah, so we're going to be
exciting.
We're going to be hopefully seeing more content, LGBTQ content. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I am too. Well, that's it for all my questions. Is there anything that has been on your mind lately that you've been wanting to talk about, or just anything?
Nah, I'm not going to take up too much of your time. I got a lot of stuff on my mind. We'll be here all night.
Okay.
But thank you for having me. I know we've been planning this for a while, and I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Honestly, this is such an honor. I really, of all people, like, I look up to you so much. So to have you on the show, I know, like, you're so humble, but really, you're one of my heroes, so it just means the world to me.
The category is Live Work Pose.
to A Filminist Pod. Thank you again to our special guest, Valerie Complex. This episode was recorded in partnership with our friends Listening Party. Be sure to follow the Listening Party crew on Instagram at Listening Party Presents and at Canal Street Market. Thanks again, everybody.
Just one of your many toys. You don't own me. Don't say I can't go with other boys. And don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me what to say. And please, when I go out with you, don't put me on display. You don't know me. Don't try to change me in any way. You don't own me. Don't tie me down, 'cause I'd never stay. And don't tell me what to do. And don't tell me what to say. And please, when I go out with you, I don't tell you what to do.